President Trump is wrong.
Mike Pence rebukes Trump over January 6th. The ACLU sues Todd Rokita, plus criminal justice reform rollback and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending February 11th, 2022.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
Former Vice President Mike Pence recently rebutted Donald Trump's false claims that Pence somehow could have overturned the results of the 2020 election, saying that the former president was simply wrong. In a speech to the Conservative Federalist Society in Florida, Pence addressed Trump's intensifying recent efforts to advance the false narrative that he could have done something to prevent Joe Biden from taking office. Pence was clear and unequivocal. He said he had no right to overturn the election.
The presidency belongs to the American people and the American people alone. And frankly, there is no idea more un-American than the notion that any one person could choose the American president.
Pence in the past has defended his actions on January 6th and said that he and Trump will likely never see eye to eye on what happened that day. What effect will this have on Pence's political future? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney. Republican Mike O'Brien. John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, this is going to sound snarky, but it really isn't. Has Mike Pence cost himself a chance at the Republican nomination for president?
No, I don't think you'd take that as snark at all. I think that was a legitimate question, but it may be coming less so if you just look at just the past week as an example. I thought, I was proud of Vice President Pence for, one, his actions on January 6th, but two, for what he said this week. And I thought he picked the right forum, the Federalist Society, who believe in the written word of the Constitution, first and foremost, which was the duty that Vice President Pence and the was fulfilling on or attempting to fulfill on January 6th. But I think we're starting to see, and I think the RNC vote to censure Liz Cheney was perhaps a turning point, if not a more defining moment on just how divided the party is. Mitch McConnell, for one, was as vocal coming out of the back end of that vote as he's ever been, by calling it a violent insurrection, with the only purpose of which was to prevent the peaceful transfer of power. And he just said that's what it was. It was a brief statement, but the most succinct way and most accurate way, in my opinion, that you can define the actions that day. Now, I think, you know, Kyle Hupfer and others have defended the RNC, and that's certainly his role. And I don't disagree with those who are concerned that Democrats are going to take the January 6th commission and go well beyond its charge. We've seen plenty of examples of that with how COVID's been administered and reacted to and used to leverage social change and every bad idea they've had for the last quarter century in this crisis that we've had the last couple of years. So I don't disagree that the January 6th commission is going to be used as a political weapon, but I thought Vice President Pence, minority leader, McConnell, their comments this week, hopefully are a wake-up call and setting the party right on the right direction and accurately defining what happened that day.
And Delaney, same question. Has Mike Pence cost himself a shot at the nomination?
I don't think he had a shot at the nomination. I mean, he obviously broke with Trump, and Trump controls the party. When you have these polls that say that 70% of the Republicans believe the election was stolen, you know they're no longer in touch with reality at all. And frankly, Mike Pence was exactly right. He had nothing other than an administrative duty to perform. He had no right to overturn the will of the people. But I thought he should have gone farther in his comments and sort of said, and Donald Trump is wrong. The election was not stolen. The election was legitimately Joe Biden's victory. And I would have, frankly, had a lot more respect for him under those circumstances than just simply defending his own action in this. He's not putting to bed the lie that the Republican leadership keeps repeating over and over and over again. And, the insurrection, you have the Republican National Committee issuing a release saying that that's legitimate political discourse is absolutely incredible. When you have that kind of thing and censuring the two Republicans who had enough gumption to stand up and say, these people tried to overthrow the government, These people who stormed the Capitol and killed people in the process were trying to overthrow our government. That has to be dealt with. They have to be prosecuted. Donald Trump's role in that has to be ferreted out, even if he's withholding evidence, destroying evidence, ripping up memos, and trying to get his people not to testify. I think, frankly, that Vice President Pence ought to agree to testify and say exactly what Donald Trump said to him to try to get him to overturn the will of the people. Because this is about the fate of democracy. It really is. If these people can distort the truth to the extent that the fact that 7 million people more voted for Joe Biden than for Donald Trump and throw Joe Biden out of the White House, it is a threat to our democracy. And it's time for people who want to be statesmen, who want to be regarded well by history, to stand up. He's right. Mike's right that McConnell did that, and he is correct in that. But that's one voice. That's one voice out of a party that has been curiously silent about the threat to our democracy posed by Donald Trump and his lies. And I really think that more of them need to stand up and be counted, because it is a crucial time for our country.
John Schwanes, to Mike O'Brien's point, I think we've seen over the last week a division, a growing, or at least a clearer picture of the division in the Republican Party over the question of the veracity of the election on January 6th. Which way do you think it's going to go?
Let me resort to one of the oldest cliches in the book and get the groans ready to go. Time will tell. I mean, I think a lot of this will depend on what the aforementioned January 6th committee report turns out to be. And there may be some very damning evidence that body, that panel comes forward with, that would perhaps shake the confidence of some of that 70% that Ann mentioned in the Republican Party among its core electorate that still thinks that there was something untoward about the outcome of the election in terms of how it was managed or manipulated. So at least that's what one would think would happen if some very damning evidence that comes out. It is surprising to me that the former president has been able to maintain this sort of control over so many elected officials within his party and so many rank and file voters. But you are starting to see some cracks, some fissures in that monolith. And that's why I resort to the cliche, time will tell. I think the next few months will be very telling. We'll see a preliminary report, as I understand it, from the January 6th committee sometime this summer, final report, presumably before the midterms. And I think a lot that will be very telling. Some people may just yawn and move on, but I think that that is the best indicator, perhaps, of where this heads.
All right. Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question, and this week's question is, will Mike Pence be the Republican nominee for president in 2024? A yes or B no. Last week's question, would part-time adjunct teachers without teacher training help address Indiana's teacher shortage? Just 21% of you say yes, 79% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, the ACLU of Indiana is suing Attorney General Todd Rokita, alleging he's violating the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. For the last few months, Rokita has banned Abdul Hakim Shabazz from his press conferences. Shabazz is a longtime Indiana political commentator and writer, which includes running the website Indy Politics. Rokita claims Shabazz is not a real journalist, calling him a gossip columnist. Shabazz has long had media credentials that give him access to the state government buildings in downtown Indianapolis. The ACLU is suing Rokita on Shabazz's behalf, arguing the state's highest legal authority is in clear violation of the First Amendment. It also says Rokita's animosity towards Shabazz goes back to 2018, when Rokita objected to him moderating a U.S. Senate primary debate that Rokita was participating in, calling Shabazz a liberal media figure. Shabazz is widely considered to have a conservative bent. Nikki Kelly, I actually want to start with you here, because you've also written in the last couple of weeks about Todd Rokita. This isn't the only sort of controversy surrounding the attorney general at this moment, is there?
No. He's obviously facing this First Amendment fight. And on top of that, he took a trip down to the border invited by the Texas governor along with some other Republican attorney generals. They got a border briefing. They, you know, got a tour on the Rio Grande, things like that. They did file a lawsuit while they were down there. So there was, you know, some work being done. But unfortunately, he also took his son along with them and went to a Trump rally on the way back. Oh, and stopped at Bill Clinton's boyhood home in Arkansas. So, you know, he said that it was state funded. The office has not given out the exact costs that many of us have asked for yet. And so he's definitely facing a little backlash on that, too.
All right. So, Ann Delaney, is stuff like this from Rokita a sideshow, or does it have an actual effect on Hoosiers?
This isn't a sideshow. This is the main event, Todd Rokita. All he has done since he's been in elective office, when he got elected on the fourth ballot for Secretary of State, he gets elected in a Republican state, and then he starts taking out ads to raise his name recognition. He's used taxpayer money to ferret out the communist conspiracy in Valpo University. I mean, this is all, he is all about headlines. He doesn't care about the day-to-day operations of the Attorney General's office. All he cares about is generating publicity for himself for his next run, which will be for governor. And the irony of this is, you know, the legislature hasn't passed the latest round of unconstitutional laws that they're going to pass when they get through the Senate, get signed by the governor. So meanwhile, this will just fund the ACLU in Indiana for another year, because between the legislature and now Todd Rokita, they keep passing and trying to have these clearly unconstitutional pieces of legislation. And the ACLU files suit, and the ACL wins, and the ACL is awarded their fees. They probably don't even have to do fundraisers anymore. The state of Indiana is funding them. So it's not a sideshow for him. It's the main event. That's all he's ever been about since he's been in elective office. It's just like two clowns butting heads between Abdul and Todd Rokita. It's kind of amusing, actually.
Mike O'Brien, is this stuff from Todd Rokita, is this something that should matter to everyday Hoosiers?
Well, the pesky part about the First Amendment is sometimes it means you got to listen to people who you don't agree with and be asked questions by people you don't like. You don't let elected officials pick and choose who they think the media is and is not. There are clear standards for that. The court's going to figure that out. Regarding the trip, I think, you know, I think a lot of these trips are both. We see this conflict all the time when elected officials are running for office, but also serving in office, and the lines that you have to mind and how careful you have to be in that. So we'll figure out what was what for the Rokita trip, but that's not a balance that's new to Republicans or Democrats at any level not to run for office.
All right. Well, Indiana lawmakers are poised to undo a major pillar of the criminal justice reform they undertook nearly a decade ago. The reversal comes as a lack of local mental health and addiction treatment resources have left county jails overcrowded. The 2013 reform effort aimed to keep people convicted of low-level nonviolent felonies out of the state's prison system. Instead, they were supposed to go to community corrections and treatment programs. But many counties don't have such programs, leaving offenders in county jails. And Jasper County Sheriff Pat Williamson says jails aren't equipped to provide necessary help.
So I don't have my psychologist or any of that stuff in the jail. And I have a mental health professional that comes maybe every 2 or 3 weeks.
The Indiana Department of Corrections says it does have the programs to help those in need of mental health and addiction treatment. And so a bill this session would give judges the discretion to send people with low-level felony convictions to state prisons. But Angela Phelps, a former offender, says in her experience, there's a wait just to get into one of the DOC programs, leaving little time for a low-level felon to get help before they're released.
From my standpoint, you're not going to get treatment. And then the mental health services, that's still voluntary.
The bill cleared a Senate committee Tuesday. John Schwannis, during the House floor debate, this bill was widely supported in the House, including by Matt Pearce. But Matt Pearce said that this bill was an acknowledgement of failure on the part of the General Assembly to fund local treatment programs that they just don't have. Is he right?
He's right about there not being sufficient number of mental health programs. And sadly, this is not just an issue for those who are incarcerated or those who are facing charges. mental health in this state services are woefully insufficient. They are in other most other states as well. Sad commentary, because that is a health crisis probably on par with COVID in many ways, and certainly exacerbated by COVID. So we can start by stipulating that, yes, there is a shortage of those services at the local level, that offenders who were sent to county jails for whatever reason were not getting those services, and presumably it is because there was no money to fund those services. I think that's clear. So I think the reason there is bipartisan support for this bill is the notion that, yes, back in 2013 when this passed with broad bipartisan support, that was the hope. It didn't materialize. So I guess there really is only one option now to keep the county jails from bursting at the seams, and that is go back to the old way and make sure that level six felons are routed potentially back to the state system.
Nikki
I
Kelly.
Think there's another way, though, John. Wait, I want to just make one point on this, Brandon. When they passed this bill in 2013, I thought they put money in there for regional jails to be done. And the sheriffs in these various smaller counties couldn't agree where the regional jail was going to be. But I thought they allocated funds for that.
They didn't allocate funds for it. They delegated authority to do that for multiple counties to coordinate and build a regional facility, which is really expensive. Well, I mean, it's hundreds of millions of dollars that these locals have to go figure out how to finance.
Well, so is it to build a new prison for crime?
Yeah,
but
the politics are different. I think you know that.
Yeah, because some sheriff may lose some, jobs in his local jail if they wind up.
And that's a real thing. Right.
Yeah, it may be a real thing, but it's not the first consideration.
And to be fair, Representative Randy Fry, Republican Representative Randy Fry, who's the author of this bill, has said that, yes, this bill, as more low-level nonviolent felons are moved to DOC as opposed to local jails, yes, there is a cost savings involved here, but he's repeatedly said that's not the reason to do this. The reason to do this is we need to get these people treatment. Nikki, John talked about the idea of going back to the old way, but is some of the progress here that the DOC has programs that they've never had before, or at least not when this 2013 law was passed?
I don't know. They definitely have programs, but I think it was made very clear in the hearing that, we're talking about low-level felons. Most of them are only going to get a year sentence. You serve 6 months, you spend 6 weeks in intake. Like, there's physically not enough time to get them into the programs. And then they're out in another 4 weeks, because that's how our system works for these low-level offenses. So I do think there is a real question whether the DOC has the programs or not, whether these people are in there long enough to make use of them.
Mike O'Brien, is this a failure by the state government to not fund enough of the and help create enough of these local mental health and addiction treatment programs so that the 2013 law could have worked as it was designed?
Remember, the 2013 law created a new felony class and created this lower level felony class, which the DOC at the time was concerned was going to overwhelm their network. And so the compromise at the time was to keep them at the local level. And of course, there was this conversation from sheriffs and the DOC and that conversation about, okay, who do we resource in this to address mental health? And, it's also important to remember that mental health and awareness in 2022 is not what it was in 2010 or 2011 or 2012 when House Bill 1006 back in 2013 first took effect. So in part, you're constantly revisiting this to try to drive resources and manage populations in the appropriate facilities and not put too much of a strain on one part or the other.
And Delaney, I think it's vital to note here that this is discretionary. It's not automatic. It's the judge can look at each individual case and decide the best place to put this individual person. So is that going to be the important part of whether or not this is effective?
Well, I frankly think giving the judges discretion is always a good idea. That's one of the problems I had with the federal sentencing. Is the judges had so little discretion because they're in a better position to evaluate whether someone could be even perhaps released as long as they sought out treatment on their own. I mean, those are the kinds of things. If we're serious about dealing with mental health and addiction issues on this, we probably need to get to facilities that are designed just for these. May take hundreds of millions of dollars, but But so be it. Do we want to keep having recidivism among these populations, or do we want to try to help them overcome either the addiction or get treatment for the mental health? And we, as a community, as a state, need to decide that. And if we're serious about it, that means you put money into it. You don't just move them from A to B. You put money into getting them what they need to get so that they don't come back again. And, you know, frankly, with our legislature, I don't think that's going to happen.
All right. House Speaker Todd Houston this week resigned his executive position with the College Board, an organization that runs the SAT College Admissions Test. Houston has been senior vice president with the College Board since 2012, when he was first elected to the General Assembly. He has faced some criticism for his College Board role, while Indiana House Republicans pushed through a bill last month mandating that classroom materials be vetted by parent review committees and placing restrictions on teaching about racism and political topics. But the speaker insists the legislation had no impact on his decision to resign his nearly $500,000 a year job.
These short sessions are intense, they're time-consuming, and I just wanted to have that opportunity to focus on this, catch my breath pro session, and look forward to kind of having a little bit of a break.
In a statement, the Indiana Democratic Party called Houston a walking conflict of interest. Nikki Kelly, I'll agree with Houston that this short session has been particularly intense, but are you buying that this year's legislation had no impact on this decision?
I did ask him. I said, it seems a little coincidental. Basically, some activists really went after him the few days before on Twitter and really pulling the College Board into it and basically saying you should contact the College Board, look at what this guy is doing. And, you know, on Monday, he resigns effective immediately, no notice. So, I mean, and you're resigning a $460,000 job for full-time job for a $76,000 part-time job. I mean, I'll take him at his word, but it definitely seems a little hard to believe.
Mike O'Brien, to that point, is this a little hard to believe that this legislation that is so controversial has no impact on this job?
Well, I know Todd, I'm friends with Todd. And I know he's been thinking about making a change professionally for some time now. But the pressures of the system, Democrats better be careful if they're going to start throwing walking conflicts of interest statements at citizen lawmakers, because it's on both sides of the aisle. It is very common for teachers in real life to set teaching policy and lawyers to set judicial policy and insurance agents to set insurance. That is a consequence of a citizen legislature, and it is getting more intense. It is consuming more time in these legislators' lives. But it starts to get pretty hard to find good people to serve in these positions who've got to go make a living in real life and who are going to just have arrows thrown at them for conflicts of interest when they have to vote on any number of things that in some cases may overlap with what they're doing in other parts of life.
And Delaney, beyond the point Mike just made, let's say Houston did resign because of this legislation that's moving and it was incompatible with what the College Board wanted or whatever. Is that a bad thing? He is a citizen legislator. He made a decision to devote himself to the legislature. Is that so bad?
Well, if you take what he said on face value, no, it's not so bad. And Michael's right. Whenever you have this part-time legislature, you're going to have conflicts of interest. What I find most interesting about this is the fact that Todd Houston votes on so many of these bills. I don't remember Brian Bosma or Mike Phillips or other speakers in the past voting except when it was absolutely necessary. I mean, why would you go out of your way to vote on something that you knew was going to pass overwhelmingly to begin with, and arguably, at least on the part of some people who are contacting the College Boards, obviously anathema to an institution that fosters learning and fosters higher education. I don't quite understand why he does that, except, you know, that the base of the Republican Party has so much control that you do things that are against your own self-interests.
Most of those former speakers, you know, were trying to stay a little clean on the controversial stuff because they thought they might run for something later. That was not uncommon. Mike Phillips of all people. Come on.
All right. Very, very quickly. It is Super Bowl weekend. We have the Bengals and the Rams. Really quickly, we'll start with Nikki Kelly because, of course, we need to start with Nikki Kelly. Who's going to win on Sunday?
Obviously, I'm rooting for the Bengals, and everyone else should be too.
John Schwanis, Rams or Bengals?
Bengals.
Mike O'Brien?
Bengals.
Anne Delaney?
Nikki said she'd beat us up if we didn't go for the Bengals, so we're all for the Bengals.
All right, 5 for 5. Let's go Bengals this Sunday. And that is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Anne Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR. Or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy. Please get vaccinated if you can. And join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.